Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May 16, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Kula Sakaka Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha debates Sakaka, a Jain proponent. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So before I do the Dhamma talk, read the sutta, just a quick comment on our retreat this past week, and it really was just amazing. Those that were on the retreat really utilized the framework of the Eightfold Path for the entire retreat, and it was amazing. Really, and from just to be a part of it. So the next one is October 19th. I'll have the registration up for that probably in about a week. This one went so well that I can just about guarantee awakening for everyone who attends the next one. So. But maybe not you. I think you're just about there. Just a speck of dust. A word about the... Yeah, Hami. Just a kind of an update on Becoming Buddha, the book, soon to be Becoming Buddha, the movie. I'm so silly tonight. Residual effects from LSD from many, many years ago, I guess. Hopefully, yeah, it's not something else. We had a great discussion on becoming and the Bhava Sutta, and that led me to realize that I need to include more in the book about that rather than just a cursory explanation. I mean, that's kind of a huge and central misunderstanding of what that means in all of Buddhism, and it's been a debate for many, many years. So that led me to write another chapter for the book, which led me to write one more chapter on the Loka Sutta for the book. And in doing that, I realized that I needed to restructure the entire book to relate to all that. So
this
it fits
all happened since you got back from the trip.
It all happened about 4:30 this morning. I woke up with it. Wait a minute. And then I realized if I'm going that far, I might as well put a chapter in on mindfulness because it's not in the book. And then I decided that I'm gonna hire an editor. Because it really is foolish to try and do that yourself. And the book proves that. And I interviewed a guy today. And he's going to do it. And he's going to do it for a fairly reasonable amount. So the new book should be out by the end of, or the new book, this book should be out by the end of June or very, very early in July. So, and when it's out, all those that are on retreat will get another copy. And those of you that weren't, we'll work something out.
You have to buy another card.
Yeah, it's well. That was the reason why I didn't put mindfulness in there. It's just the book is going to be coming around 400 pages now, and trying to keep the cost down. You know, every page costs a certain amount of money, but I think I'll still be able to keep it around $25.
Change your font size.
I was just going to say, change your font size.
Well, if you notice,
the
font is nice and large
for somebody
who's slowly going blind. That's the kind of books that we.
I did appreciate that.
A few people mentioned that. People that nobody mentioned and said it was too big, but the people that appreciate the size of the font, they mentioned it. So
I mean, you could probably go a little smaller, but
I can't.
I don't like small font anymore either.
I was thinking of going a little bit larger.
Big block.
Because what?
It's going to be more valuable because it's the unedited version.
The ones you have. Frank was saying that before.
So you have to sign it for me.
I will, and date it. Someday you'll be one of those eBay millionaires with that book. The Kula Sakaka Sutta.
In
the
Kula, say that again?
The Kula Sakaka Sutta.
Kula?
Kula.
Sakaka?
Sakaka.
It's a new product, my coat.
Kula vaguely means about, so it's the sutta about Sakaka. In the Kula Sakaka Sutta, the Buddha is confronted by Sakaka, a follower of Nagantha Nataputta, the local leader of a Jain sect. The Jain religion was already established a little bit before the Buddha started his teaching career, when it was rather well established and rather well populated. There were a lot of followers of the Jain religion, just as there are today. Jain is still one of the world's major religions, despite this debate. Sakaka is accompanied by a group of approximately 500 Lakavis. The Lakavis were a society ruled by a religious oligarchy. Sakaka was a well-respected Jain teacher known for using intense philosophical rhetoric and debate to show his superior knowledge. And it's interesting how that debate has filtered it through into some of the Buddhist religions, particularly in Southeast Asia. It's very revered. And if you notice the debates, have anybody seen those Buddhist debates where you're slapping and jumping around and screaming and hollering?
Tibetan.
And it really doesn't, it's a lot of, it really doesn't matter how well your knowledge is of the Dhamma, it's how theatrical you can be to win. And a good debater wins. It doesn't really matter what the underlying philosophy is. Just look at our last presidential debates. Sakaka tells the Lakavis in attendance, "There is no contemplative or leader or one who claims to be an arahant, a rightly self-awakened one," of course he's referring to the Buddha, "who would not quiver and break out in sweat when engaged with me in debate." One morning, Venerable Saji, one of the monks of the Buddhist Sangha, was in Visali on his alms round. Sakaki noticed Saji and recognized him as a follower of Gautama the Contemplative. "Master Saji, how does Gautama the Contemplative generally instruct his disciples?" "Agavasana," referring to Sakaki, "Gautama, the rightly self-awakened one, instructs his disciples in a general way as follows. Form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental fabrications are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. Being impermanent, form is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental fabrications are not self, and consciousness is not self." Of course, he's referring to dependent origination in five clinging aggregates. "All impermanent phenomena is not self. In short, the five clinging aggregates are impermanent and so not self. Agavasana, this is the general way that Gautama, the rightly self-awakened one, instructs his disciples." That name Agavasana refers to the Sakaka's clan, and that's often how people refer to people back then. They referred to them as given their clan name. "What an awful thing to hear, Master Asaji, that Gautama the Contemplative teaches this sort of thing. Perhaps someday we could meet with Gautama the Contemplative and change his evil view." A short while later, a group of Lakavis, about 500 in total, were gathered at a meeting hall. Sakaka addressed the group. "Come with me to debate Gautama the Contemplative. If he takes the same position with me that he does with his followers, I will thrash him about statement by statement. I will amuse myself with Gautama." The Lakavis, knowing both teachers, were mixed as to what to expect. Some thought Sakaka would prevail. Some felt the Buddha would prevail. They followed Sakaka to seek out the Buddha. They found the Buddha in the great forest. After exchanging courteous greetings, Sakaka sat to one side. Some of the Lakavis were respectful to the Buddha, clasping their hands in front of them. Some remained silent. Sakaka addressed the Buddha, "I would like to question Master Gautama on a certain point. If you would grant me the favor of an answer, ask Agavasana as you see fit. In general, what is your instruction to your disciples?" "I instruct my disciples in this general way. Form is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, mental fabrications are impermanent, and consciousness is impermanent. As such, form is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental fabrications are not self, and consciousness is not self. All impermanent phenomena are not self. This, in general, is how I instruct my disciples." "A simile occurs to me, Master Gautama. Any seed that grows and spreads is dependent on the earth. In the same way, any individual with form, in connection with form, taking sustenance from form, produces merit or demerit. Any individual with feelings, taking sustenance from feelings, produces merit or demerit. Any individual with perceptions, with mental fabrications, with consciousness, taking sustenance from perceptions, from fabrications, from consciousness, produces merit or demerit. Agavasana, are you saying form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, fabrications are myself, consciousness is myself? Yes, Master Gautama, I'm saying, form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, fabrications are myself, and consciousness is myself, as do all those that came with me. So Sakaka, that's a debater's tool or trick, if you will. You're trying to pull as many people behind you, and so he's saying that all these people believe me, so it must be true. Very well, I will cross-question you on your statements. What do you think, Agavasana? Would a noble king wield power in their domain to execute those that deserve execution, or to banish those that deserve banishment, or to tax or fine those that deserve to be taxed or fined? Is such a noble king in control of his domain? Yes, Master Gautama, a noble king would be able to control his domain in this manner. Well, Agavasana, when you say that form is self, this is great. Do you have power over that form? We talked a lot about this on retreat. If you have no control over it, how could it be you? Do you have control over that form? Do you have power over that form? Can you have your form be any different than it is? Sakaka could not answer and remained silent. Again, the Buddha asks, well, Agavasana, when you say that form is self, do you have power over that form? Can you have form be any different than it is? Again, Sakaka could not answer and remained silent. Agavasana, you have engaged me in this debate. It will be to your detriment to not answer. I will ask you one more time. When you say that form is self, do you have power over that form? Can you have your form be any different than it is? Sakaka finally relented. No, Master Gautama. Listen closely to what I'm saying. Agavasana, and answer only after you have paid attention. Your answer is inconsistent with your statements. You also said that feelings are self and that perceptions are self, that mental fabrications are self and that consciousness is self. Can your feelings be different than as they occur? Can your perceptions or your fabrications or your consciousness be any different than as they occur? No, Master Gautama. Listen closely again to what I'm saying, Agavasana, and answer only after you have paid attention. Your answer is inconsistent with your statements. Is form impermanent or inconstant? Impermanent, Master Gautama. And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful? Stressful, Master Gautama. Likewise, are feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness impermanent or constant? They're impermanent, Master Gautama. And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful? It's stressful, Master Gautama. And is it fitting to regard what is inconstant, stressful, subject to change as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, it's not, Master Gautama. So what do you think, Agavasana? When one holds to stress, is attached to stress, and thinks of stress as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am, would he understand stress or be able to be free of stress? No, Master Gautama. Agavasana, don't you hold to stress? Aren't you attached to stress? And don't you think of stress as this is mine? This is myself? This is what I am? Yes, Master Gautama, please tell me how a disciple of Master Gautama develops this instruction to end all doubt, to end all questions, to be fearless and independent of others and their teachings. Now, he's already realizing that his conditioned thinking around what he learned from the Jains and his environment isn't adding up. Agavasana, when a disciple of mine develops right view through the Eightfold Path, they then see any form, past, present, or future, internal or external, common or sublime, near or far, clearly as form has come to be. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Does this remind you of anything from the retreat? Through right view, my disciples know that any feeling, perception, mental fabrication or consciousness, past, present, or future, internal or external, common or sublime, near or far, clearly as form has come to be, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Agavasana, this is how my disciples carry my message and my instruction to end all doubt, to end all questions, to be fearless and independent of others and their teachings. Master Gautama, how does one complete the path to end all defilements, to lay down the burden and the fetter of becoming? How does one become an arahant, released through right understanding? Agavasana, when anyone, through right view, knows that form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness whether past, present, future, internal, external, common, or sublime, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Through lack of clinging to ignorant views as substance, as sustenance, they are released. Through their right effort, they have ended the defilements, laid down the burden and the fetter of becoming. They have completed the path and are released through right understanding. Released, they are endowed with unsurpassed right view, unsurpassed practice, and unsurpassed release. Released, they honor and respect the Tathagata in this manner. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for awakening to Four Noble Truths. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma to develop restraint. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma to develop tranquility. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for the ending of samsara, for the ending of ignorance. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma for total unbinding. Sakaka then said to the Buddha, "It is we, Master Gautama, who were insolent, who were reckless, in that we construed that Master Gautama would be attacked statement by statement. May Master Gautama, together with a community of monks, acquiesce to my offer of tomorrow's meal." The Buddha acknowledged Sakaka with a silence. The next day, a lavish meal was prepared by the Lakavis for the Buddha and his Sangha. Sakaka himself served the Buddha, and upon completion of the meal said, "Master Gautama, may the merits of this gift be exclusively for the happiness of the donors." This is an interesting response. "Agavasana, what has been given to you, not without passions, not without aversions, not without delusion, that will be for the donors," meaning the Dhamma is for the donors. "Whatever has come to me without passion, without aversion, without delusion, free of ignorant views, that will be for you directly." It's the end of the sutta. The Buddha's closing words reiterates that the greatest honor one can give to the Buddha and the only useful merit to be gained is to be authentic to his Dhamma, and through wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma, free oneself from all views rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. This sutta gets to the heart of the Buddha's teachings on the Four Noble Truths. What is impermanent, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness cannot be realistically called the self, as there is nothing within these five clinging aggregates that any individual can direct. And as such, what is impermanent is stressful when we try to hold on to it through clinging and craving and maintaining. It is only by ignorance of Four Noble Truths that one clings to stress and stress-causing objects, events, views, and ideas. What is impermanent is stressful. What is stressful cannot constitute a self. It is anatta. It is not self. So that's one of the reasons why I say when you find yourself caught up in worldly events, you find your mind is agitated. Remind yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, this is not myself. Because it's only through self-referential views, through clinging to things, needing them to be different than they are, that stress arises in the first place. And like we talked about a lot on the weekend, the reference to becoming and non-becoming independent origination in its immediate application addresses just that fact. To be mindful that stress arises and stress passes away. Everything is impermanent. Why insist in the moment that anything needs to be any different than it is? That can only come from I-making. This is not me. This is not myself. This is not what I am. It's the essence of the Buddha's teaching. So that's the end of my talk. Any questions? Yes, Keith.
Do you think the Jains have a different version of that story?
Wow, what a great question. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm going to try to find out, though.
Yeah.
That would be.
Yeah. What's the Fox News report on that?
Wow. I'm going to speculate. I wonder what they... I think that they would... Again, it's true. It really is speculation. I would think that they would... The Buddha obviously didn't convert all the Jains at that time because they're still Jain. I would bet that they would question their belief that Sakaka was a great debater, and he simply lost the debate, but it didn't diminish the Jain religion in any way. And again, that wasn't the Buddha's purpose anyway. He never saw himself in competition to any other religion or philosophy. But when you do question the Buddha on his Dhamma, he's going to respond that way. And he was always very clear that he's not trying to be divisive, but he is trying to present his Dhamma in a very consistent way. But I'm going to look into it.
Yeah. Also, later on, Buddhism, many hundreds of years later, really got sucked into this trap of having to debate their way into the king's favors, and debating Jains and debating later Hindu religion. And I think it did major damage to the teachings.
Oh, no doubt. And the reason why those debates were there were for so that the king could decide who. It was important for kingdoms at that time to have the greatest spiritual teacher as one of theirs, and so by the use of debate, that's usually how a king would decide, especially after the Buddha was passed.
And Buddhism at that point then relied on the favor of the kings to have their monasteries and income, and they were at that point not really wandering around too much and collecting alms.
No, and it was more important to gain the favor of the king rather than protect the Dhamma, especially when it was challenged by other people that might be taken in a better light. And so it is true that eventually, and not all that, it didn't take all that long for Buddhism to completely disappear from the country of its birth. And it's only, in the last 100, 150 years that it's had a resurgence, a true resurgence in India. But it's still not the main religion in India by a long way. Isaiah, good to see you, by the way.
Good to see you, too. So the Buddha was saying at some point that self is only what we have control over.
Yes.
Do we have control over anything? Is there even a soul?
You need to come on the retreats to get knowledge. The short answer is that what we perceive as a self, when seen from right view, is seen as a point of reference that is always in a process of what? A process of becoming. And this is one of those words that can be debated. When settled in right view, the process of becoming is always an expression of right view, and it's free of any type of disturbance in the mind. Is this making sense to you? Is this useful? The question you ask shows that you have a very good grasp of the implications of what the Buddha's teaching. It takes a little bit more than a short answer to understand really what I'm saying, but let me take it the other way. A person who is ignorant of Four Noble Truths and does not do anything to change that ignorance can only become more ignorant. And so the Buddha taught an eightfold path to recognize these views that are rooted in ignorance so that we can develop wisdom and understanding where there once was ignorance. So the Buddha is the first one that developed this in himself. And upon his awakening to the true nature of life as represented by Four Noble Truths, he lived the rest of his life, 45 more years, with a mind free of any type of disturbance. But it doesn't... One of the reasons why I'm going that far is often people will take that to mean that when we let go of all these wrong views, there's annihilation of self. There's nothing here. And the Buddha didn't teach that. That's another extreme view that has been adopted by some modern Buddhist religions and, in fact, was something that the Jains taught also. So it's important to just look at the example of the Buddha. Here's an awakened human being who lived 45 more years, probably the most important and successful human life that's ever been lived. He certainly didn't vanish, and he certainly was much more effective post his awakening than he was prior to his awakening.
So would he deny that we have egos? Or what would he call, what do we have control of that he would call self? Or is there no self?
We only have control over... And this relates to the reason why we meditate. We meditate to deepen concentration, really for no other reason. We only have control over that aspect of our mind that relates to what's occurring as life occurs. So, in other words, any projection to the past or to the future is only a memory, and we have no control over that. Most human beings live their lives. In fact, Moore brought this up on retreat in a very eloquent way. or maybe it was Lorna. Sorry that I don't remember exactly. Most human beings live their life in the past and having that past influence their future, and they miss what's occurring right now through that distractive, reactive mind. So you ask a very perceptive question. I hope I answered it.
Yeah.
But can I add to that?
No.
The Buddha would not deny that there's an ego self. He explains how that comes into being, that's out of ignorance and with contact with the and thoughts occur and feelings occur, etc. So that is, it serves a function. So through his teachings, he kind of says, see that for what it is, and begin to not identify that as self, because that is the aspect that suffers. So if we don't identify that as self, we get to experience freedom and actual wise response to what's occurring, rather than being subject to repetitive, habitual behavior. So what we do have control over, that was your second part of the question, is what we have control over is mindfulness bringing to that process and saying, wait, that's going on. What's really happening here? Can I see it clearly, letting go of those tendencies that take us away from what's actually occurring, bring us into a story about what's occurring? Sense, right? So we do have control.
So what we ultimately have control over is what's occurring in the present moment as life unfolds. And I don't mean to get fixated on this is the present moment, because there's no such thing in that way. Life is a continual process of becoming. And so what we have control over is to recognizing the arising and the passing away of phenomena, the arising and passing away of stress, the arising and passing away of any reference point in that time, even though it's hard to describe time in that way because we're so linear with that. So when Buddha described an awakening as it relates to the Four Noble Truths, an awakened right view is a view that understands stress. And it's a view that has abandoned craving and clinging. It's a view that has had the direct experience of the cessation of craving and clinging, meaning wanting anything in our lives, all the people and events of our lives to be any different than they are. That's craving and clinging. And finally, that right view is a view that has fully developed the Eightfold Path and is free of any disturbance in the mind, no matter what's occurring in the world. So it's not annihilation, that's an extreme view. And it's not complete immersion in the world through sensory acquisition, always looking to have pleasurable experiences. If you look at the usual description of the Buddha, that sitting pose is the pose that he took off his cushion all the time too. That was his calm, peaceful mind. When he described the mind of an awakened human being, the quality of a mind, he described it in that one word, calm. So, great question. I hope my answer helped. Any other questions on that? On the sutta, and then we'll go around the room, and Matt. Good to see you tonight.
Good to see everybody. This sutta sounded a lot like the Anattalokana Sutta.
Yep.
In that when the Buddha was talking to his first five buddies, he kind of took them through that same process of is form impermanent, are feelings impermanent, perceptions impermanent, mental fabrications. That which is not a self, is that impermanent? Is it permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. So it seems that Sakaka was saying, okay, well, that if we take sustenance from form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, that's who we are. And that's just what he means by saying, do we take sustenance from is we're identifying with it.
Yeah.
We're identifying with my thoughts, my perceptions, my form, all of those things as me, as this established permanent thing. So it was just neat to hear that the Buddha just calmly directly addressed it as he did his friends some years before, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And even though Sakako had a conditioned mind to believe something entirely different, that clear direction was able to penetrate that conditioned thinking, and he got it. He saw it. Thank you. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Mm. Good to be back here.
Yeah.
I had a terrific time at the retreat. I'm still chewing on a lot of things. A lot of food for thought.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, it will nourish me for a long time.
Thank you. I'm glad you were there, too. Judy, good to see you tonight.
Hello.
How's your practice been?
Getting back into it a little bit. The bit about wanting something that you don't have, not necessarily for me, but for someone else, can border on judgment, which is why it's not helpful. But on the other hand, you don't want that person to be unhappy. So if that person is not content on their path, I can't. So in other words, if one feels that one could help someone, one can do an action and try and help, but to keep the clinging part is the constant thinking about it, not necessarily doing anything about it, I would think. So if something is bothering you about something, you might want some things you want to change. You don't want it to be the way it is. And I don't mean trivial things like, you know, in your kitchen or in your car or you know. And I understand some things in life, they are the way they are, and there's nothing you can do about it. But some things you can, obviously, while trying to improve ourselves by being here. So this is where I get a little caught up in, is it clinging or is it just wanting someone something better for someone?
So it's a good question. And it touches on the difference between acceptance and approval. It touches on an understanding mm-hmm. that dukkha is a natural occurrence. Well, it's natural. Dukkha occurs in the having a human life. Sometimes just worldly causes and conditions create suffering. Sometimes it's people's actions that create suffering. There's nothing in the Dhamma that says that we should not attempt to be helpful towards other people in any way that seems appropriate. Letting the Eightfold Path guide that. But also understand that when we take the view that we know how other people should act, or we determine how the world should be, now we're getting caught up in craving and clinging rooted in ignorant views, because that's simply what occurs in the world. And it's very easy to, again, I always use the example of the Christian Crusades, but the modern jihad is the same thing. You know, we out of a ideological point of view, we just decide that we're right and everybody else is wrong. And so what follows from that is, even though I might have to kill a few thousand people to save a few thousand more, that seems like reasonableness.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about anything, you know, about what I think the other person should be doing. Is just that I want them to find a path for themselves, but they're not doing anything to develop a path, so when is intervention?
It depends. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
And as a family, well, can I say who it is? No, I won't use a name. As a child, you're a parent, and your example and your guidance is part of being a parent, whether that child's going to accept it as something else again. And at a certain point, you might realize that there's not much that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'm not saying I know your situation, so I'm certainly, I know that there is still things that you can do, and I know that he listens to you, and so you're not there yet. But again, all that you can do is offer guidance, and the example that you show him is important. Shouldn't have said him. Show him. And beyond that, he's really up to his own resources like everyone else is. So again, the Buddha didn't teach the Dhamma to be salvific or that he would be a savior or that we will be saviors. The only thing we can do is to develop the Dhamma and our understanding and then hopefully to be a mindful presence towards others.
So basically, if I get that my example can be basically a more useful example or a more helpful, instead of even trying not to, there's always a whiff of judgment.
Well, but that's on your, that's up to you to recognize and slowly abandon. It's not, you're certainly not wrong in any way, Judy, that you might still judge that he should be different than he is and even be attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an extreme view right now to expect that you shouldn't have those feelings.
Right.
And hopefully you'll develop to the point where no matter what occurs, you'll be able to be at peace with what's occurring, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll have a peaceful mind in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You'll simply understand this is a consequence of living in the world for you and for everyone else. Sometimes there's just not anything we can do for others.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly as a mother, you're going to try, and the more that you can remain mindful of the framework of the Eightfold Path, the more you'll be able to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. Does that make sense? So you're likely to still have fear, or maybe.
And that's really what it is. I'm worried for him.
But you'll also understand that fear doesn't have to be any different than it is. Does that make sense? It's not, the fear isn't wrong. And I would say blaming him for your fear would be.
Mm-hmm.
That's the judgment.
Right.
But understand that it's to have concern about your own flesh and blood is reasonable. But what do you do with it? You know, you can do a lot of things. You know, some people will drink an extra bottle of vodka every night. Some will kick the dog. Some will punch the kid. Some will do all kinds of different things. Or you can recognize that this fear that I have over this current situation is reasonable, and just let it be as it is and act accordingly. Because when you react to it, you're likely going to create more of a disturbance in his mind and your mind.
Right.
And you might even isolate him. Pardon me?
That's what I'm trying not to do.
Yeah.
And I realize that even when I'm trying not to, I have been. So.
But you were doing the best you can,
what
I'm saying.
I'm not blaming myself per se.
Good.
I'm trying to be more effective.
Yeah. So one of the great freedom that comes from integrating the Eightfold Path is that when you do integrate it and you act within the framework of it, you realize very quickly that you've done everything you can and there's really nothing else you can do in a skillful way. And that brings great peace. It's when we don't have that framework for how to act that we start trying to force the issue. So engage in right speech and right action with him. Let that guide your thoughts and your own actions, and I think you'll find great peace in a less than peaceful situation.
And the right speech, I haven't really read enough lately, so I'll go back and do some reading. But the right speech implies...
The first thing is that you're honest, but always within... Sometimes honesty is also... We practice restraint.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that can be an aspect of right speech and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
Speech that is necessary, and that means that you say things that are likely to have an impact, and if you don't think they are, an aspect of right speech is, again, practicing restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And another important aspect of right speech is to not be hurtful. So that's where fear and frustration can come, that you so-and-so and this and that and blah, blah, blah. That's never helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find that you fall over into wrong speech, the first thing to do is recognize it. The Buddha acknowledged that. You know, when he taught how to develop right speech, he said to be mindful of wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech, which implies that there's probably going to be one or two times when we might engage in wrong speech, come back to right speech. Let the Eightfold Path, I mean, that's what we're doing here. Let the Eightfold Path guide you in all areas of your life, and if you can do it in this area, it will be an incredible learning experience. It takes, one of the reasons why we meditate, why it's the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, is it takes great concentration simply to remember to do that in the appropriate situations.
Yes.
If our minds are distracted, then we're just reacting. So
exactly.
I hope that's helpful, and
no,
thank you for bringing it up. It's important.
It is helpful because I'm trying to apply this to things other than my own personal growth, and I haven't been doing as much, the reading or anything as I tried to before. Sometimes I have just trouble getting through it, even though it's not that hard. It's like I keep thinking I should be doing something else, but it's like,
There's,
so I have to give myself that gift of time to do that, like I do this.
Yeah, on the website and also in the Truth to Happiness book, in under the Four Noble Truths, there's a section where it says what it means to awaken to each truth, and then there's a section on the Eightfold Path where it describes very clearly what that really means and how to integrate it into your life. So it's a great question. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you.
Diane.
Parenting is not an exact science.
Oh, no.
And you're never going to do it perfectly, no matter how perfect you get the sutras and everything else.
No, I never expect to do it perfect. I'm trying to be effective.
Well, I think the most important thing that I've gotten out of this is the gentleness.
Yes. And
if I'm gentle with me, then I'm not going to yell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to force my will and my shoulds on somebody else.
It's more the, not so much the yelling, but it's the shoulds.
And then and that's, I have to really pull back from that, because with my son, it's his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted someone to allow me my life, and I rebelled like blazes when somebody was taking, the control over my life. And that's what, I mean, to me, this is what I've been finding out for myself, in my life, is meditating twice a day is the most important thing I can do for my overall health.
Mm.
Because it's that, like we were talking earlier, that ego thing in there, that conditioned thinking, wants to do what my parents did to me, wants to do what I just read from Dr. Phil or something like that. I mean, all over the place, there's conditioned thinking coming at me. And when I hear, and I'm beginning to find this out, by meditating twice a day, the answers that I need for any given situation are inside me, and they come from me and my heart, my essential nature, my deepest part of being, and that's what he's saying, the example. I mean, what I would urge on you is that meditation, to continue and develop that, within the framework of the Eightfold Path. But so many parents have the
I like the meditation.
You're doing, I think you're saying what you have said in your question says is, did you love this child?
Mm-hmm.
And from that, the answers will come.
Thank you, Diane.
That was
beautiful. Thank you. This is how the Sangha works. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. The retreat was fabulous, and the immersion in it allows you to become saturated, less distracted. Some of the greatest gifts came from the other members of the Sangha and the things that they were sharing, the clarity that they brought to it. So it was really fabulous. The sutra tonight, the thing that was amazing to me was how this man of great ego and narcissism, came from up here and came down to here with his understanding. I thought that was pretty astounding. So that was a surprise to me. In one conversation. so it's good.
Thank you. It really, it's when you, obviously Sakaka did have somewhat of an open mind, even though it was conditioned, and he was able to hear it.
He did seem to have a pretty big
impression
of himself.
He was ready to wipe the ground with the Buddha. The Buddha, there's so many stories of that where the Buddha confronts or is in a situation where it seems there's no way that mere words are going to get him out of it. And, he always does. Angela Miller, the murderer always comes to mind. He just taught him the basic Dhamma in Angela Miller.
Well, he did by throwing the question back at them. So yeah. They answered the question themselves.
Yeah, we talked about that on the retreat.
Yeah, rather than having the answer given to them.
Yeah.
They had to come up with the answer.
Yeah, and he led Sakaka to his own understanding, mm-hmm. rather than beating him over the head with
right.
the truth.
Yeah.
Doesn't work. And that's that's another.
Same thing.
My parents told me for years, this is how you should be, and every time they said it, I was just the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know.
So, and when my mother says I'm afraid, and then I start to understand what it's not like. She'll come across as judgmental, but I'll sometimes say, Mom, what's going on? And she'll say, I'm afraid you're not going to be happy. I'm afraid you're going to mess up your life. And so we've learned to like kind of stop and identify, I'm afraid and I love you.
Mm-hmm. I was just finishing writing on the Loka Sutra, and there's a line in there where the Buddha says, desire leads to fear. Desire always leads to fear.
Desire leads to fear.
Meaning, wanting something to be different than it is, more of something, less of something. There's always that underlying aspect of fear in it.
And you know, the funny thing is, I've tried to say, look, I'm not telling you what you should do. You just need a path. So I just told him what he should do. He needs a path.
Well, but notice the Buddha also told Sakaka, you know, and he didn't. Again, the Buddha didn't just say, go meditate and be good people. He said, he understood conditioned thinking. He said, you need a path. You need an eightfold path. Follow this path.
That's kind of what I was saying. So this is helpful.
It should be. Keith, good to see you. How have you been?
Good to see you. I've been good. My
good.
Practice is going well. I'm very happy to be here, see everybody. And really don't have a lot tonight, but just happy to be here.
I'm happy you're here. Good to see you. Diane, good to see you. Thank you again for taking care of old Bodes.
And
Jiso and
Simon. Oh, yeah, and the cats, too.
Someone get me sidetracked on cats and dogs. I'm learning concentration, right? Thing about conditioned thinking and the ego and stuff. I think in my other life I was a scientist or something like that, because I've been experimenting with meditation, and when I do meditate and when I don't meditate, and what happens when I do and what happens when I don't, and I can report that my findings are, you know, literally amazing. I really wish that when I had children, I was meditating when they were little. But that is not the way it was, but it is. I mean, I have this now. And the thing that, again, I keep coming to is I can't do it for my son.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do it for anybody else. I'm doing this for me now, mm-hmm. because I'm finding that people, even though I'm on, you know, I think I'm trying to do all this good stuff, people still try to manipulate me. People still try to do things to me, to get me to do things their way and to control me and stuff like that. And it's when I when I don't meditate, I react.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I do meditate, it's like I don't react right away, but something comes in my mind and I see, oh, this is what's going on.
And I don't have to. You only get the power when you react.
Yeah, but it's like meditating and not meditating. I'm actually, you know, almost tangibly seeing a difference in the way I work, my mind works, conditioned thinking works, and it's kind of been a good experience.
experiment, but I think I should be done experimenting.
You have to have a conclusive evidence.
You have to
peer-reviewed study.
Thank you, Diane Einstein.
We'll vouch for it.
This is why I said it once, I think, that the most loving thing I can do for myself, those that I care about, and all sentient beings is to take to a well-focused Dhamma and awaken. And now, as if my hair was on fire. Isaiah, good to see you tonight. It was really a great question. So. Do you have anything else, any questions or any comments?
Oh, no, I've just been trying to, I spend a whole lot of time, wasting my time. And just thinking about stuff, so I've been trying to slow those down and not into formal meditations, because then I get antsy, but just to slow down all the time I usually spend wasting, just thinking about stuff.
The common human problem is we waste time. In fact, you could say that the common human problem is wasting their lives in things that are inconsequential. Have you been meditating at all on your own?
They usually don't last too long.
How long, if I can ask? I don't mean to put you on this. You don't have to answer if I'm making you uncomfortable.
A couple of minutes. It depends. So.
Frank, how many minutes did you start with a meditation practice?
Three.
How many are you meditating now?
45.
A little bit at a time. It really is a key. And if I didn't say that to you when your first class, I'm sorry, because I say it to everyone. Start with short periods of time. 2 minutes is fine. If you can, and don't have any expectations except to maintain the method. So when you're meditating on your own or even in here, are you able to recognize that you're caught up in your thoughts, and you come back to your breathing?
I'm usually caught up in my thoughts, and I can come back to my breathing, but I don't know. I don't really mind not having a spiritual experience.
You're not going to have it. It's not really a spiritual experience.
I don't mind not having one, because if I do, then I want one again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. that's why, again, nothing unique there either, Isaiah. Meditation is primarily for deepening concentration. If you have experiences, that's fine. Note them and come back to the sensation of breathing. Start with short periods of meditation. Do the best you can to be mindful of getting caught up in your thoughts. Come back to the sensation of breathing. There's a recording of this meditation on the website that you can download and let that guide you. that has 5-minute callbacks. And if you need to have, callbacks are just the reminders that I do to come back to your breathing. If you want me to make a short tape of maybe 5 minutes with a call back every minute, let me know and I'll make it for you and send it to you. Then that's all you need to get going.
One of the things that I guess I'm curious about is that since I'm not chasing after anything, I'm not so motivated to meditate. And when I had meditated before, after half an hour or something, I'd get real calm, and I feel great. And after I got up, I feel even better. And so if it's not about, if it's not about that, what's it about? And is it about?
Boy, another. You got some great questions. So,
where you been,
It's okay to. There's nothing wrong with having those experiences. In fact, I would say, if you can use this method, and eventually you feel great, great. Just don't hold on to it. But it's fine to have that. We should feel good after meditation.
So, it's part of your meditation to, say that it's to have a pleasurable life?
As one factor of the Eightfold Path, the entire path leads to a life of lasting peace and happiness.
Okay.
And that is the goal. It's what the path leads to. And if you only come to a few classes, you'll hear me say over and over again that it's not just meditation that an awakened human being taught. Meditation is one factor of eight. And it's the entire integration of the Eightfold Path that leads to a life of lasting peace and happiness. And it's also the other 7 factors that contribute to deepening meditation. In other words, it's very difficult to calm your mind when all you're doing is meditating. Because in that state, all you're doing is reinforcing that thinking that creates that busy mind in the first place. But off your cushion, as you begin to integrate the other factors of the Eightfold Path, you'll see that that contributes to your meditation practice, and your meditation practice supports the refined mindfulness. The concentration you develop in meditation supports the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the entire path. And over time, but very quickly, as you integrate the entire path, you'll develop that mind that you're looking for. That peace that you feel occasionally in meditation, you'll be able to take it off your cushion and into your daily life. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so through the Eightfold Path, you can have desire without it becoming fear. Like, where does desire fit in?
The only skillful desire, especially at this point, is the desire to develop the Eightfold Path and let that guide you. That's called chanda. It's skillful desire. And I can see you have a brilliant mind. That can be good and it can be bad. Don't get too analytical with it, because one of the things that the Buddha kept saying over and over again is ehipasika, meaning you have to come and experience this for yourself. And the only way you can experience it is to develop it. What we do here, what I do from this seat, is to teach how to do it. But nobody here can give you the experience of it. But once you have the experience, am I right, folks? Mm-hmm. It changes everything. So go easy on yourself. The word I usually use is be very gentle with yourself. Don't get too frustrated. And if you remember that meditation is primarily for deepening concentration, if you don't have great experiences every time, that's fine. If you maintain the method as best you can, every meditation session is successful. Mm-hmm. It's pointing you in the right direction. And develop the Eightfold Path. If you can be part of our Sangha, it'd be wonderful to have you. And I think you'll find great support. Don't run out of here. There's a book that I wrote that I want to give you that you might find useful too. Okay? Well, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad you're part of our Sangha. Maura.
I would just say that I wasn't going to have anything to say except just with Isaiah, is a concentrated mind that's able to stay focused and present for what's coming is a very pleasant mind. So you can, as you were just saying, you're seeing through your life that your thoughts, your daydreaming and all that is starting to loosen up. And that's more pleasant, right? Because that churning can sometimes be, I know for my own self, it can be quite unpleasant sometimes. Except, you know, you can go into that la-la land. But the felt sense of a concentrated mind is very pleasant in and of itself. So when you come back to the present moment, you begin to kind of just build on that natural ease. Even when things are unpleasant, there's that natural ease that's still there. So there's some buoyancy around it. It's not so tightly clung to the situation. So, there is, a skillful desire, as John talked about, is part of really, wanting an awakened mind, wanting to get some space around this clinging and stuff. So those are good things to want. You know, we all want happiness. We just have to follow the path that really creates that when we get confused as to what really creates it. So,
thank you.
There's something Joe. Else. Just a sec. I'm sorry. There's something else about meditation, and for me it's important to say this. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a difficult path because stuff comes up that I don't like about me, and I look at situations come up that I think, oh my God, I did it. I was trying to blame somebody else all the time.
Stuff comes up, and when this
stuff comes up, it is not easy to deal with it. But this is this gentleness that I'm learning to practice through this is, at first when the stuff started to come up, I would beat myself up like I normally did. And now I'm just learning, I can be gentle and I can breathe. I can almost feel my chest, relax. So I'm not, lasting peace and happiness, it means getting real with myself and becoming honest, and it's not easy. So this is in a Jesus Christ Hallelujah meeting, and I'm no disrespect or anything like that, but it's just not easy. And I think it's, so don't expect it to necessarily be easy, because it's some days, you know, I've been doing it off and on, so I haven't developed a really good practice, and some days I just can't do it. But I say, okay, try again.
You'll see that the Eightfold Path helps even when you don't want to do it. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, and that can guide you and remind you that you want to develop the path. And the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is right effort. And that's just a reminder that, yeah, you got to put some time on your cushion. You got to put some time developing the entire Eightfold Path. But it doesn't take a tremendous amount of effort. But it takes some effort. It takes some focus.
You know your
own mind. Yeah. Again, be gentle with yourself. It does take some time, but it doesn't take a long time. Again, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's doable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I hope you continue. Joe, good to see you tonight.
That's good to be here. What is it then?
I'm glad you're here. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here tonight. I really am enjoying teachings and sutras on the five clinging aggregates and dependent origination. That's where my ego goes every day, and my path of meditation and finding this, has been great for me. And I'm thankful that there's a teaching, simple, because everybody has their own theories and formulas. And that's their own personal experience. It doesn't apply to everybody. Peace of mind, my mind can't produce, but it's what I experience when I practice the Eightfold Path. Noticing where I'm attached to a not-self and the stress that creates in the impermanence is all the reason to let it go, you know. I was always stuck in a vicious cycle of needing people and hating people at the same time, trying to control the outside world to fit my needs. And it never worked for me. All it did was strain relationships. You know, the worst thing I ever did for my children was help them. Not when they were babies, but like when they became adults. And I think the best thing that I could do for them is let them fall on their face and just be there to give them a hug and brush them off and say, go back at it again. My daughter, she told me she was moving to Oregon for 3 months, and she told me on the weekend that she's staying. She's coming home to get her car and drive back. You know, that's not how I had her life planned out. I could see where that is. My attachment, my ego is attached to that, you know. And it's so, it feels so cool and peaceful. And this is where the peace of mind that I was never able to produce before, unless I was drinking a Jack and Coke, just becomes really tranquil and peaceful. I'm like, you know, good for you, go at it. And we'll be right here. I don't need to change anything.
So. Good for you, Frank. Yeah, and you're not willing to give up that peace of mind for anything.
I don't need to.
Yeah,
that's the spiritual experience that I have every day.
Yeah.
You know, the experience of mindfulness practice while meditating is the spiritual experience. And every thought that arises, every feeling that is created, that I don't have to attach to, I get goosebumps. I'm so thankful.
Yeah. Your direct way and simple way of expressing the Dhamma came up quite a few times on retreat.
When I heard you read the sutta, all I heard was the Buddha saying, we're powerless over this ego. And this is the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
This will lead you out of it.
That's right. That's right. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Yeah.
How are you?
Well, thank you. I also enjoyed the retreat an awful lot, got an awful lot out of it. And I think I sort of realized a lot of stuff, really the heart of the Dharma, that isn't easy to see. And as you go, be quiet somewhere for 4 days.
It does make
a
difference.
It really does help to be in that company and in such a quiet location. I'm doing Qigong, which helped. Just so pleasurable. I think what I mainly got out of it was seeing eye making and understanding what eye making is and how we reflect on ourselves and on our past and on the future, and you know, that it's just foam on the water. You know, it really is not substantial at all. It's just thoughts. It's just a thought. And I've come to realize, I once spoke, we were talking about meditation one time, and I once said that meditation is like the arrow of where we're trying to get. We give ourselves perfect conditions to calm our mind, meaning we go somewhere, sit quietly, think about your breath when a thought comes in, get back to your breath, and just sitting quietly alone or with company. That's really the ideal conditions you can put your mind into quiet. And I realize that the moments when you are meditating and you're not bouncing around with thoughts, your mind does eventually quiet down and you can just sit in peace. There's no thoughts. You're not trying to even hold on to your breath anymore. You're just in peace. And it occurred to me that it's the eye making that is preventing you being there.
Yes.
And I've never thought of meditation like that. I've never put that together like that. So knowing that, how we are in meditation, again under perfect conditions, it gives you insight in how to try to get there off your cushion as well as on the cushion, you know, and understand that it's your own ego and your own eye making that's preventing you for being at peace, which you can see in meditation, but it's not really very clear in life. Is it going through your life? But just realizing that, I mean, it just gives me so much hope and as I say, just understanding what eye making is. I'm not saying I can see all its forms at the moment, but I've certainly been made aware of a lot of its forms and how totally devastating it can be. And you know, you change the reality through eye making. You literally can change what is happening through your own referential thoughts. And it's just astounding. I never saw it as what it is before the retreat. So.
Thank you. That's it. Yeah. It's very skillful insight, Lorna. Yeah. That's what it's about. So.
I had to struggle to get there.
Yeah. Well, it was from the heart and from the mind, directly from the mind. And again, this is what the Sangha is all about. So, thank you, Liz. Good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone.
Thank you for the pictures you sent too.
Retreat was amazing, but in a real, and I this was sort of the energy of the group, was it was just a lot of equanimity and skillful applications of the Dhamma. I think the most important thing for me was realizing, well, first of all, I just wanted to say to Isaiah that the only thing you have to do when you're meditating is focus on your breathing. You don't have to memorize the Eightfold Path. You don't have to memorize the Four Noble. Just that's the only thing you need to be doing when you're doing your meditation. And sometimes your mind can wander on the Dhamma while you're meditating. And for me, it's a better application when you're not meditating. If you just concentrate on your breathing, it makes it very simple. And so that was one of the things that I discovered was how simple this is. That not that it's not difficult, but that it's simple. That when you find yourself outside of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, it's a direct link to a form of ignorance,
mm-hmm.
and that by going back into it, we were talking about feedback loops. That anywhere along the feedback loop of the dependent origination, if you interrupt those thoughts or interrupt that activity of what's happening, the whole thing falls apart. So if you find, for me, I needed to find a reference point that when I'm in a situation where I clearly feel like I'm not in direct contact with the Dhamma, I need to look at what particular area of ignorance I'm caught up in, whether it's not accepting impermanence or it's not accepting dukkha in the world and it's not a condition of the Eightfold Path. Using the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths as the feedback loop to stay within the practical application of the Dhamma. And that was just such a incredible moment for me because, but not in a way that I thought, I made no eye reference to it. So it was just what was happening. That information finally, John finally said it in a way that it sunk in. Because he's probably exhausted with the number of times he says things in different ways. Let me try saying it this way. Let me try saying it that way. And it just finally, whereas in the past I might have gotten overly excited about it, I shed two or three tears and that was it. And I realized that this was important information. So it was a good retreat in a very calm and stable way. It wasn't, wasn't hallucinogenic. Except, could have been. had some vegetation around. I could have made it that way. But it was just very, it was like, well, it's like, when you're ready to hear it. So thank you, everyone. I mean, that was really terrific.
Yeah, thank you. When you're ready to hear it, you hear it, but you also have to be in the right environment.
Sure.
Yeah. And you describe the reason why, to me, a real retreat, or at least the way we experience retreat, is not a retreat from the Dhamma by substituting an ascetic practice like forced silence for 4 days. But being immersed in the Dhamma, whatever reason would you want to? How other way would you like to spend 4 days? But up at one Dharma center, enveloped in the Dhamma, can you imagine the difference? If we had a forced silent retreat, we wouldn't have gotten much out of it. But I bet you we all got a lot out of the noble silence at the meal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That made the use of silence a skillful use, and I enjoy that every year. I don't know if you notice me, but I tend to look around while I'm eating at the group, enjoying their noble silence during a meal. It was great. You had a question?
Sorry, when was the next retreat? October.
October 19th to 22nd.
Okay. Calendar now.
Please, and I'll have the registration up. I think in about a week or
is
so.
Is that Columbus Day?
I think Columbus Day is the week before.
Okay.
what? Oh, and it's going to be Thursday to Sunday.
As long as it's not Father's Day this week.
Yeah, really.
Well, and I'll do my best. I think I checked that next year's date that I reserved is not Mother's Day, but I don't know. I reply.
Made at least one mother happy.
Bonnie, it's good to see you.
Good to see you and everybody. Well, a lot's been said. Just practicing and trying to be mindful about when I'm fabricating and how that feeds in to the links. And so by stopping it and stepping back, it's been really very helpful for me in the past week. And, well, the Eightfold Path with my guide.
Thank you.
We should get bumper stickers. The Eightfold Path is my pilot.
That's great. Any other questions or comments? More?
Can I say two things? One on about the retreat. Yeah, it happened last retreat too. And people will sometimes say, "Well, oh, you know, how was the retreat?" And I heard it in what everybody said. And it's certainly been my experience that it's like it's very difficult to put into words how the depth of the integration of the teachings occur in the retreat setting. Because so it's not like you come back like, oh, I've just, you know, been like chilling and, you know, quiet. It's like it's always a level of insight. And so, you know, along with the silence and the beautiful Qigong, and I used it for a woman with a elbow fracture that I've been working with, and she was complaining this morning, and she said, "I still can't touch my head." And I said, "I'll see you later, Anna, and we're going to do something a little different." And she just kept, she could not stop talking about it for 2 hours. I don't know what she did. "I can touch my head. I didn't do anything. I can touch my head." But it was releasing tension throughout the whole body. So 97 years old, she's like, amazing, in love with Qigong now. Which call it chai tea.
Chai tea.
What other thing I have to share this. I'm sorry, Frank, but it I won't be able to make sense of it, but I heard it today. It was a story about when you're trying to help somebody from your perspective, and the person doesn't want, so they use the analogy of this group of seals that were bringing owls fish, and they would just, they work all day long to bring these owls the fish, and the owls didn't want the fish, and the owls would take the fish and have to get rid of the fish, and they were mad at the seals for bringing it. But this went on for years and years, and the seals bring in the owls fish, and the more that the seals did it, the more resentful the owls got at the seals, and the seals tried to bring them more fish. You know, and it was just ridiculous when we get in these ideas of how to help from our perspective and how that creates such problems. And your description with your children was just, as I'm always going to be thinking about, oh my gosh, I'm bringing fish to an owl. How stupid of me. So, like, that's just a good answer. I want to share that because it's a powerful visual and metaphor of what happens when we're overly needy or overly wanting to help. From our perspective.
Can I just add, tack something onto that? I'm not the only one making eye making. And when I realize that other people are eye making, it changes the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. It does. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am.
And it's not personal.
So yeah, and I guess I I do need to acknowledge Maura and her leading the early meditation, and Matt, that the both of you, the Qigong brought, both of you brought so much. I know I set it up there, but the retreat would not have been the same without you or without anybody else that was there. You know, if one of you was missing, wouldn't have been the same. So. All right, we'll finish with the with metta, the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class.
Thank you, John.
Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.